current medications are, in fact, allowing people with HIV to live longer, and that means many are developing other problems common in older adults. We visited Roy from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who's dealing with these issues.
I've been living with HIV and AIDS for 24 years. I always thought coming up that I would never accomplish anything. As a child, you know, I had a speech problem, but just to be able to be a leader, to give back, it's a lot.
Hey, what's up, lad? Good, how y'all doing? Hey, what's up, how y'all doing?
Okay. I started two support groups in 1987. Can you just talk about why it's important for people with HIV to be at the table? Early on in my life, in the 1980s, I really got into my drug addiction. I was homeless, and I'd done anything necessary to get the drugs. I remember early on, before I found out that I was HIV, I went to the blood bank, and they said they couldn't take my blood. In 1988, I was diagnosed with AIDS. My T-cell count dropped below 200. Back then, there was only one medication, and there were 12 pills a day. That medication was $8,000 a month. I take 8 pills for my HIV and AIDS. I take 2 pills for my high blood pressure. I take 1 for my arthritis. I take 1 for my high cholesterol. I take a vitamin, and I take an aspirin. And I take 3 pills for the gout. I started having a problem with obesity 20 years ago. My sister, she died from a heart attack. My grandmother was diabetic. My doctor said, look, you have to start eating right or you'll die from a heart attack. My doctor told me that I'm at risk to be a diabetic, and so I need to change my habit. So she brought me to a nutrition. I went to the nutrition, and she gave me some tips on some of the right foods to eat. My eating now is better. I like to eat bread. I try to eat a lot of vegetable. I try to stay away from a lot of fried food and try to eat a lot of fresh food. Exercise is good for arthritis. I like to walk the pool. I like to walk, especially in the park. You know, just put exercise just for the fresh air and meditate. Because sometimes I think, far as being healthy, too, people got to realize that meditation is very important too for the mind, body, and spirit, so that's real good. And if you have HIV, you could live a long period of time. Not like it was 25, 26 years ago. But high blood pressure, you know, high cholesterol, that worried me, because I know that could take people out. That look at me, almost 60 years old, realize I must be doing the right thing. I guess by me helping other people keeps me going.
Dr. Sweet.
Well, Roy is a wonderful man. He puts a face to something that people like Charles and I see all the time. It's an aging population. He has conquered taking his antiretrovirals. Obviously, he's doing well. And yet he tells you his risks. He's obviously had some lifestyle problems in terms of weight, and he has the arthritis, which keeps him probably from exercising a lot. He has multiple comorbidities, the other things that people that age get. So some of them can sometimes be due to medications that are from your heart therapy, but quite frankly, his genetic predisposition is something we see increasingly in the African-American community, a predisposition towards hypertension and diabetes and dyslipidemia, heart disease. And that is one of the things that makes care of this population challenging. The first and foremost important thing is that you have to control the virus. That is, to have your life go on and to be able to achieve this kind of life expectancy, you have to take your antiretrovirals. But then on top of that, as he points out, he has his arthritis drugs and he has his diabetes to deal with, and he's trying to work with his blood pressure. And we have to, as HIV clinicians or anyone who's taking care of an HIV-infected patient, deal first and foremost with keeping the virus suppressed. But then on top of that, you come in with all these other meds, and you have to think about some of the drug-drug interactions, the toxicities of the other medicines, the quality of a person's lifestyle when they have to take multiple medications. So Roy points out really the heart and core of what we're seeing in many of our clinics, people like me and Chuck that have had patients. Some of my patients have been with me for over 20 years, and they are getting older, and they're getting lots of other things. And I think he points that out in a very, very personal way.
It's interesting when I'm teaching in our clinic. It's a university-based clinic, and I frequently have medical students or residents work with me in clinic. And about halfway through the clinic, invariably one of them will say, you know, we hardly talked about the HIV part because the guy's virus is well-controlled. Mm-hmm. He's tolerating his medicines. He's been on the same treatment for 3 or 4 years. And we spend most of our time talking about the diseases that are part and parcel of getting older or that he's had for a long time, like his depression or perhaps his social situation. And I think people who are caring for HIV-infected patients really have to be very aware of how to manage these other conditions, because otherwise your focus on HIV alone doesn't serve the greater needs of the patient. And it's really become a much more complex management.
And, you know, from the community medicine perspective and the public health perspective, what really struck me about the video was the fact that Roy really has a support system around him. He's a part of his community. He's engaged in the community. He's giving back to HIV prevention in his community. And that's been associated with better outcomes, both psychological outcomes as well as health outcomes. And I think it really underscores the importance of not just focusing on the antiretroviral medications, but ensuring that as a clinician, you have networks or referral systems so that much more holistic approaches to that patient's health can be achieved.
Well, as Roy mentioned, high cholesterol is one of his many health issues. Are there special considerations for treating high cholesterol in patients who have HIV?
Well, yes, is the short answer. Whatever you do, though, with the dyslipidemia, you want to treat to the same guidelines, the NCEP guidelines that we all use for cholesterol and dyslipidemia in our non-HIV-infected patients. The goals are the same in HIV versus non-HIV. Now, which medicines we use because of some of the drug-drug interactions may be different, but people approach this in different ways, and I probably would allow him to stay on the same antiretroviral regimen and add medicines to get his cholesterol to the guideline goal that I want. There are others that might switch out his antiretrovirals if he's on something and there's an option in order to perhaps alleviate some of the dyslipidemia. And I don't know where you are, Chuck, but...
Well, it's a good point, Donna, and obviously every patient is different. But I've kind of changed my approach to this as we've gotten more HIV therapies available to us. I think if we believe that part of the problem with his cholesterol is related to his antiretroviral therapy, given the many different treatments that are available to us today, I'm more and more inclined to say this drug is causing a problem. If we can safely substitute an alternative drug that will have the same antiviral effect but may alleviate the cholesterol problem, I'm kind of in the place where I would prefer to do that rather than adding another pill to deal with a complication created by a former pill. And I think when you do the latter, you're asking them to take more medicines or more potential drug-drug interactions. And again, if it's safe, if it's possible, if the resistance patterns are appropriate, my preference these days is to try and substitute something to alleviate the problem rather than treating on top of what we've already used.
Dr. Hicks, what about high blood pressure? Do HIV medications have an impact there?
It's unlikely that high blood pressure is attributable principally to antiretroviral therapy. I think it's more likely that high blood pressure is something that that person would have been afflicted with just on the basis of their genetic background.
Charles, I think that's an important point for us to remember, that as the epidemic is evolving and beginning to impact more on minority communities in the U.S. Many of these communities have higher prevalence of some of these conditions, as you said, whether hypertension, diabetes. It's really important that we don't jump to the conclusion, especially in hypertension, that it's the antiretroviral drug which is causing this, and that we need to look at what's that patient's background, what are their risk factors, what are some of the environmental factors that could be driving, especially hypertension in that patient, as part of their treatment options.
But again, what's nice about the antihypertensives, by and large, there's not the great deal of drug-drug interactions with our antiretrovirals. You can pretty much use the same algorithms in HIV-infected patients on ART as you do in anyone else.
Type 2 diabetes is another common condition as people age. Can HIV treatment interfere with type 2 diabetes treatment and vice versa?
Well, I'm not too sure that interfere is the word I would use, but certainly we know, one, that our patients, as they're growing older, many of them are in the right demographics to be at risk for type 2 diabetes. Our minority populations, and with the obesity epidemic, as we get older, we're more at risk. So there's that issue. There are some of our medications that have contributed to glucose intolerance. That was more common in some of the older medicines, like Indinavir that we used, where there was glucose intolerance. So there is more diabetes, I think, in the HIV-infected population, especially as they age, for multiple reasons. In terms of treatment of that condition, it very much is the same, however, as it is for anyone else. Our goal is a hemoglobin A1C of 7%. We want to treat to that goal. We want to start with lifestyle modification, diet, and exercise, which can make a huge difference if a person can do it. Metformin, which is an insulin sensitizer, is the drug of choice in the HIV-infected patient as a first line, just as it is in a type 2 who's not HIV-infected. Once you move beyond that, some of the glitazones, there's some controversy about whether or not they have more risk in the HIV-infected patients and go to some of the newer agents, or insulin. And insulin is just as useful in type 2 diabetics with HIV as those with not.
As patients with HIV live longer, obviously cardiovascular disease is just one of the many concerns. What do clinicians need to know about kidney disease in patients with HIV?
So one, you have to be aware that the population getting infected is at an increased risk already. The medications, some of the medications we use can contribute to renal disease. Tenofovir is the one that's been most publicized. There have been increased kidney stones with Indinavir and recently with atazanavir. So one has to be aware of the potential nephrotoxicity of some of our drugs. And then the underlying makeup of the patient population, if they have coexisting hepatitis C, they're more at risk of renal disease. So. And then there's HIV itself, because HIV is a cause of HIV nephropathy. And really the only treatment of HIV nephropathy, if someone gets into that situation, is adequate treatment of the virus. So you have this sort of yin-yang where you need to pick the best medicines to control the virus. You have to be aware that they could have some toxicities. But if you don't control the virus, end-stage renal disease with dialysis is a very real happening, especially in our African-American population who's coming into care late, who've already got significant renal disease from uncontrolled HIV, then it makes it sometimes more difficult to pick the right regimen.
In a heightened awareness of the possibility of kidney disease is really important here. We've started to screen more rigorously for proteinuria, for example. I also think that as our patients are living longer, as Rhea has alluded to, the potential for the factors that lead to renal dysfunction become more manifest. So diabetes, hypertension, a genetic predisposition. And then as they also require more medications, it is quite remarkable how many of them are potentially nephrotoxic, including some of the antiretroviral therapy. So I think an awareness of kidney disease, I think interventions to control those factors associated with renal decline in a sort of upfront way, and more rigorous screening, I think, can all translate into a greater likelihood that this is not going to be an issue.